All right, good morning, everyone. I was thinking something kind of, it made me chuckle. I was thinking of how, you know, there are times I'm like, hey, you know, why don't we come a little closer? And I was thinking, now everybody's real close, right? Looking around, in fact, I was thinking, somebody took my seat. Only thing is, he's bigger than me. And so it's like, well, what you gonna do? You know, family of people walking here looking like the Incredibles, and it's like, you gonna fight them? No, you move up to another seat. But it's great to see you all today. I know who it is, but, you know, he's still in my seat. Anyway, it's interesting. We've been talking about the prophets. We've been going through this series looking at the different things that the prophets went through in order to carry out the message, in order to proclaim the truth. And one thing that was established very early on, and it doesn't take much reading about each of the prophets, no matter what land they were in or what they were actually, who they were actually talking to, one thing is very clear to see is that they weren't always received very well. They weren't always taken, they were taken seriously, it is, people just didn't care that much, right? And so much of what they were preaching and so much of what they were proclaiming, it kind of fell on deaf ears. You know, they had very little success, if you want to call it success in that way. And what I want to look at today, the prophet I want to focus on today, is kind of interesting because he's one of the prophets who, frankly, had a great deal of success, if you measure success in that way. There were lots of people who received what he said and listened to him and not only heard what he said, but they responded in a very favorable way. And yet, if you look at the totality of his ministry and all that God asked him to do, he ended up having a lot of doubt towards the end. He ended up having a lot of second-guessing and uncertainty towards the end. And you know, we don't always view his life that way, but it's important because when we think about ourselves, in our walk with God, very often we encounter doubt. We encounter certain degrees of uncertainty. Oftentimes we can lack faith. And it's hard to believe that a man who was chosen by God, he's a prophet of God, he literally has the words of God that he is speaking from his own mouth, falling off of his own lips. Sometimes it can be hard to believe that doubt can set in, or even maybe more appropriately, that doubt should set in. See, oftentimes we're kind of ashamed. We won't admit as Christians that we have doubt, that there are certain things that we're kind of uncertain about. And what I want to look at today, as we go through and we look at a very small portion about John the Baptist, I want us to really consider for ourselves, how does God view doubt? How does God think of us when we have doubts about his plans and how he's working in our lives? And more importantly, how should we respond to those feelings of doubt? The title of the sermon today is, I'll Allow It. I'll Allow It. Because very often, we can almost feel like, man, you know, I'm not certain. I don't necessarily understand what's going on here. I'm not sure. My faith is rattled. And God's response to us is, I'll allow it. I will allow it, but it's how you respond to that doubt. You know, we think about doubt. The word doubt, apparently the word appears, from what I can read, around the 13th century. It derives from several other words. I guess most recently something that was French, but then also going back even further than that. And it comes from a word that could be most closely translated as dubious. The idea that there's some type of duplicity or there's conflicting ideas. So essentially the word doubt, put in more common language, is when you believe something that is true, you understand something to be true, but now you've been introduced to something else, you've seen something else, And it causes you to raise concern that maybe what you previously believed was not true. That is doubt. And even just looking at that, my little, you know, Billy Craig's common definition for doubt, you can see why doubt is not something that, frankly, we can avoid. Because there are going to be areas in our life when we're going to doubt. But how do we deal with that doubt? We'll see that John the Baptist had to deal with that doubt. I want to start here in John chapter 3, verse 22. It says, after this, Jesus and his disciples went out into Judean countryside, where he spent some time with them and baptized. Now, John also was baptizing at Ainon near Salim because there was plenty of water, and people were coming and being baptized. This was before John was put in prison. An argument developed between some of John's disciples and a certain Jew over the matter of ceremonial washing. They came to John and said to him, Rabbi, that man who was with you on the other side of the Jordan, the one you testified about, look, he is baptizing, and everyone is going to him. To this, John replied, a person can receive only what is given them from heaven. You yourselves can testify that I said, I am not the Messiah, but am sent ahead of him. The bride belongs to the bridegroom. The friend who attends the bridegroom waits and sits for him and is full of joy when he hears the bridegroom's voice. That joy is mine, and it is now complete. He must become greater. I must become less. Now, we start here because, you know, people are getting a little bit concerned, right? They're saying, wait a minute, this guy who you were talking about, he's got all these people who are following him now, you know? John's ministry, if you want to call it that, was kind of changing. And he lets them know that, you know what? This is to be expected. It is to be expected that the person who I'm prophesying about, this Jesus, it's expected that I become less as he becomes greater. So John was very clear on his duties. He was very clear on who Jesus was and what was supposed to happen. And I want to continue here and look at another portion of Scripture in Luke chapter 7, because we're going to see where this doubt starts to creep in. We're going to see a clear example of this in Luke chapter 7, verse 18. It says, John's disciples told him about all these things. Calling two of them, he sent them to the Lord to ask, are you the one who is to come, or should we expect someone else? When the men came to Jesus, they said, John the Baptist sent us to you to ask, are you the one who is to come, or should we expect someone else? At that very time, Jesus cured many who had diseases, sicknesses, and evil spirits, and gave sight to many who were blind. So he replied to the messengers, go back and report to John what you have seen and heard. The blind receive sight, the lame walk, those who have leprosy are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the good news is proclaimed to the poor. Blessed is anyone who does not stumble on account of me. After John's messengers left, Jesus began to speak to the crowd about John. What did you go out into the wilderness to see? A reed swayed by the wind? If not, what did you go out to see? A man dressed in fine clothes? No, those who wear expensive clothes and indulge in luxury are in palaces. But what did you go out to see? A prophet? Yes, I tell you, and more than a prophet. This is the one about whom it is written, I will send my messenger ahead of you who will prepare your way before you. I tell you, among those born of women, there is no one greater than John, yet the one who is least in the kingdom of God is greater than he. We'll set the scene here. John the Baptist is in jail, And he sends a couple guys to ask Jesus, let me get this clear, Jesus. Are you the one who's to come? Or is there somebody else that we're waiting for? Now see, John has been prophesying, he's been preaching. All these people are coming to get baptized for repentance. They're turning their lives back to God, and yet John is having some doubt here. He's been in prison for a long time. They estimate he's been in prison for approximately up to a year at this point. He's kind of reconciled the idea that he may never see freedom again. And it wasn't just his own circumstances, but not only is he hearing about Jesus baptizing these people, not only is he hearing about what Jesus is doing and healing and teaching all the people, but he himself, being a Jew, he's hearing about Jesus hanging out with the lepers and hanging out with the tax collectors. He's hearing some of the things, you know, notice in John there where we read how they said, you know, this guy that you were telling us about, you know, we just got done hearing him talk about, you know, the ceremonial cleaning and how, you know, that was not what God cared about. So John is kind of like, wait a minute. This is a little bit different than what I expected. He's starting to have some doubt. You know, when we go through our lives, sometimes, you know, I was thinking to myself, if we did a show of hands, how many people in here have been Christians for more than 20 years? Just quick show of hands. That's a lot of people, right? And here's the thing, you know, I'm sure there'd still be some hands raised if I said 30, right? The thing is, we go through our walk with God and we treat each other and we treat ourselves like we're always supposed to be the good soldier. We should never have questions. We should never doubt. But what happens when something changes in the church and it doesn't look like what you're used to? It's not something that you're familiar with. This doesn't quite make sense to me. I don't know how to make peace or reconcile this different direction. These kids are doing things so different now. It doesn't quite jive with what I grew up with and what I understand. And this is kind of what John the Baptist is dealing with here. He's saying, yeah, I expected you, but I didn't quite expect some of the things that I'm hearing about and that I'm seeing in your ministry. And yet, with that doubt, with that, I can't quite make sense of this, John did what was all important. He did what all of us should do whenever we face doubt. He didn't go back and do more research and exegesis and you know, interpret the original Hebrew. He didn't go back and try to find more, you know, literature or read more commentaries. He sent a message directly to Jesus. He went directly to Jesus. He said, Jesus, I need you to make sense of this for me. Make it make sense. Very often when we doubt, when we don't understand everything that God is doing, that is allowable. We see all the prophets went through that on some level or another, where they weren't quite certain exactly what God was going to do. We looked at it last week where Jonah literally said, you know what, just God, I just don't agree with you. You know? Jeremiah is literally saying, I'm going through all of this. I'm tormented. I'm sad. People aren't listening to me. I'm taking shame for your name. Make this make sense. As Christians, we will always go through moments where it doesn't always make sense what God is doing. And yet, when we wrestle with our faith, even somebody, we saw what Jesus said, I tell you, among those born of women, there's no one greater than John. Jesus understood how great John was, not only because of what he did, but his purpose. See, very often we look at John, we forget that he was an Old Testament prophet. You know, we forget that he actually predated Jesus. And he says how great he was. Think of how great he was, and he still had some doubts. But he went to Jesus. He didn't sit on it. He didn't lose his faith. He went to Jesus. When we're in the midst of that doubt, when our faith is troubled, do we, in fact, go to Jesus? Do we go to him and say, make it make sense? You know, I was thinking of doubt and losing faith and what that looks like. You know, I've had different experiences, a lot of them, frankly, where I've had doubts. Anybody in here who, you know, understands anything knows what it's like to have doubts. When you have been praying for something, you know that something is supposed to be this way in your mind, but God says, no, I'm going to do something different. And it isn't always something as simple as what we just read. It isn't always as cut and dry. Because see, you know, we have the ability to look back. See, we know about the empty tomb. One of the things that we forget about with all the prophets, when it talks about, you know, the least being greater, and it talk, you know, that applies to us. The reason why we're greater is because we have the benefit of the empty tomb. We have the benefit of seeing how God worked. We have a benefit of Jesus on the cross. The prophets never saw that. So for them, they were talking about something that they had not realized, and we're going to come back to that in just a second. But when we think about faith and doubt and sometimes just frankly being afraid that maybe God isn't listening. Maybe this God thing is not everything that I was told it was. Maybe this isn't, you know, what I thought. Maybe I need to go back and revisit this thing because I'm starting to have my doubts. You know, there's a few quotes here. Let your faith be bigger than your fears. I don't even know who said it, but it's true. How do we get to that place where our faith is bigger than our fears? You know, there are more ways to see than with your eyes. Faith requires, and you know, we talked about this in Sunday school, faith requires that we be able to, frankly, our walk of faith, our walk with God is about saying, you know what, I'm willing to suspend belief and trust him. Even though my eyes or my ears are telling me something that I would otherwise do something different. Faith is taking the first step even when you don't see the whole staircase. We look at the prophets. We look at this situation with John the Baptist. John the Baptist would later go on to be beheaded. He would never see what was going to come of Jesus' ministry. He would never see Jesus on the cross. He would never see the weeping and the mourning. He would never go on to see Jesus' empty tomb. He would never go on like the rest of the disciples and be able to see Jesus come back and appear to them. He wouldn't go on to see this, but his faith carried him forward, even when it didn't make sense. You know, why is this Messiah, why is he doing things that we've been taught in our tradition are not to be done? But our faith has to carry us where our eyes and our ears and our other senses can't. Faith is not the belief that God will do what you want. It is the belief that God will do what is right. Very often, you know, and I talked about this earlier, how you know, God has the benefit that we don't have of being omniscient. He's seen everything. You know, where we have to go back and dig up the Dead Sea Scrolls and do all this, you know, putting things together, God's like, yeah, I was there. You know, I know exactly what I meant when I said this. I know exactly why I allowed this thing to happen in your life. And while you doubt, and while you have some concerns and some questions, and while you sit on the edge there and kind of look over at Nineveh and you have some questions as to why I did this, Jonah, see, I'll allow you to have the doubt, but you cannot remain in that place where you are stifled and you have no faith. You have to be able to have faith that allows you to carry on through. There's a passage I want to look at here in Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11 is known as the faith chapter, right? Talks about all these great men and women of faith, and I love this part, but it speaks directly to what we understand about all the prophets, frankly, all the people in the Old Testament that we read about where, and starting verse 32, it says, "And what more shall I say? I do not have time to tell about Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, about David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, and gained what was promised, who shut the mouths of lions, quenched the fury of the flames, and escaped the edge of the sword, whose weakness was turned to strength, and who became powerful in battle and routed foreign armies. Women received back their dead, raised to life again. There were others who were tortured, refusing to be released so that they might gain an even better resurrection. Some faced jeers and flogging, and even chains and imprisonment. They were put to death by stoning. They were sawed in two. They were killed by the sword. They went about in sheepskin and goatskin, destitute, persecuted, and mistreated. The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains, living in caves and in holes in the ground. They were all commended for their faith, yet none of them received what had been promised, since God had planned something better for us, so that only together with us would they be made perfect." You know, I think here, especially at the very end, when it says, "Yet none of them received what had been promised, because God had planned something better." You know, we think about what we do together as a church, how each individual member makes up the church. We are the body of Christ. And you think about that and how we're here to not only help one another, but to be able to help others find a relationship with God as well. And so often when we have doubt, we can shrink back. When we're languishing in our faith, when we're kind of drowning in negativity, it can be very easy to pull back. And what we see in these examples, these countless different examples of these people of faith, it says that none of them received what had been promised. Think about what it is to have faith and go do something and put your life on the line and even give up your life, but then you still didn't get the reward. See, people will look at you and say, "What a fool." People will look at you and say, "Well, is that really worth it?" You know, who goes out and gives their life like John the Baptist only to be beheaded? Only to suffer shame and ridicule and to never ultimately get the promise. But that's exactly what they did. That is what it means to have faith. Very often we have to think about it in context. It's 2019, right? What happens if we give and we put in and we invest the energy in the heart and we pray and we sacrifice so that God's work can be done here on earth, so that God's work can be done here in little old Dover, but you never live to see the fruit of your labor? Is it still worth it then? Is it still worth it then? Because very often, the way that we look at ministry, the way that we look at the church, we look at it like, "I want to do this thing because this is a need, and I want it to be done right now, and I want it to be done this way." But what happens if all of your work is passed on to someone else? What happens if you never even see and realize all of the energy and the time and the effort that you're putting in? That's what made John the Baptist so amazing. Because even though he had doubts, and even though he would never see all of what we know about Jesus, he still had faith. He still continued to do what was right and what was necessary. He trusted God. Faith not only requires that we fight beyond our doubt, it asks us to work for what we won't see. It asks us to do things and work towards things that at some point, you may move to another place. You may die. it may not even be something that you'll benefit from or you'll never get the credit. You know, we have the ability to read back in the Bible and see all these things, but as it goes through and talks about them being in chains and flogged and beaten and killed, see, we get to look back at them like when we read through Hebrews 11 and see them as heroes. But they didn't get that. Someday, years from now, I fully expect that I'll be heralded as a hero. Some of you are looking at me like, no. It was a joke, guys, really. The thing is, I can't live a life that says, I want to be a hero now. I want my name to be up in life. I want to be heralded as something great. See, when you have faith, your goal is not to receive everything that you want or that you even feel like you expect. We talked about entitlement last week. And see, that's what we see when we think about what it means to have something deferred. Our faith means that we are willing to defer some of the things that we want, those things that we have come to expect. What happens when God is going to use your pain? He's going to use your hardship to further his kingdom. Are we willing to do that? Are we actually willing to sacrifice in that way? You know, I appreciate earlier when Lee was sharing the story about her son and losing her son. See, the thing about it is, you know, and the question was raised, we were talking about how when people say things that are sometimes insensitive, even if they don't mean it, where they'll say, well, maybe that was God's plan. Well, guess what? Obviously, it was God's plan. But that's not even the approach that men and women of faith should have. It is not only that it's God's plan, but God is going to receive glory somehow because of your faith and your willingness to trust in him and hold on to him, even though right now, like John the Baptist, you're in jail. Even though right now, you're facing being beheaded. Even though you're being ridiculed and shamed, your faith says, you know what? I'm going to go beyond my doubt, my sense of confusion, and I'm going to continue to trust in God. You know, I talked about the church and how we make up the church, and it doesn't matter if you go to a big church, big building like this, or you come to this one, or whatever it is. Very often the difficulty that people have with church is when it doesn't look like what they expect church to look like. It doesn't quite fit what I think of. You know, it's like, well, you know, they don't praise and they're worshiping the songs and all kinds of, it's not quite the way that I'm used to it being. Or, well, you know, there's a lot more young people than what I'm used to, or a lot more older people than I'm used to. There's all these different things. And I had a friend of mine several years back. They're like, well, what kind of church do you go to? I said, well, it's just a Bible-believing, you know, Church of Christ. And they said, well, I mean, but is it a mixed congregation? You know? And I said, well, I don't know that that necessarily matters, other than the fact that we shouldn't be excluding people, you know, from church. Well, yeah, but if it's not a mixed congregation, then it's not really representative. And I said, well, what happens if you go to, you know, Nigeria? You know, it's not going to be that mix, right? You know, they're all Nigerian. You know, the idea that we have these concepts and these ideas and these manifestations in our mind of what the church should look like, and that's all fine and good. The problem is when it doesn't quite look the way that you expect it, and then you say, well, you know what? I'm not really going to give my heart to this. I'm not really going to pour in this. I'm not really going to be all in on this church thing because I'm kind of not getting what I expect it to be. I put this picture up because I think of how there are things that we're doing here, you know, with our, you know, what some places call house churches and Bible talk meetings inside of homes. And that is different for some people. They're not used to that. That's not what they've come to expect. Or even when I remember we started doing children's church, and there are people saying, well, no, I kind of feel like the kids need to just sit there and be quiet, you know. And I'm like, well, I'll just offer you a ruler. You slap them on the hands, on the knuckles. And here's the thing. It isn't always going to look the way and feel the way that we want the church to feel. it isn't always going to present in such a way that makes sense to us. Everybody in here comes from someplace different. Dover's a very transient little place, right? Like, there's very few people I know, except for, like, you know, I talked to Leroy, and he's like, yeah, I'm, you know, born and raised here. But very few people are actually from here. Everybody came from somewhere. Mark, he's from down the street. But nobody's really from here, right? Nobody's really born and raised here. Everybody comes here through the Air Force, takes a job, you know. We all have different ideas. But yet there's one church. We're supposed to be unified and understand that even if it doesn't exactly fit our expectations and our ideas and what it is, if somebody does something that's a little bit misplaced and out of line with what we expect, this is still God's church. This is still what Christ died for. We are still one church. And we cannot lose faith because everything about our walk with God and everything that we experience with the body is not exactly what we've come to expect. I'll close here in Ephesians chapter 4. Starting in verse 7, it says, "But to each one of us, grace has been given as Christ apportioned it." This is why it says, "When he ascended on high, he took many captives and gave gifts to his people." What does "he ascended" mean except that he also descended to the lower earthly regions? He who descended is the very one who ascended higher than the heavens in order to fill the whole universe. So Christ himself gave the apostles, the prophets, the evangelists, the pastors and teachers to equip his people for works of service so that the body of Christ may be built up until we all reach unity in the faith and the knowledge of the Son of God, and become mature, attaining to the whole measure of the fullness of Christ. Then we will no longer be infants, tossed back and forth by the waves, and blown here and there by every wind of teaching, and by the cunning and craftiness of people in their deceitful scheming. Instead, speaking the truth in love, we will grow to become in every respect the mature body of him who is the head, that is Christ. From him the whole body, joined and held together by every supporting ligament, grows and builds itself up in love as each part does its work. We see here something very important that directly relates to our faith. We see here that everybody has their own different part. Everybody has their own separate duty. And it's not for the hand to understand what the ear does. You know, my hand has 43 years of experience, as does the other hand, and they commonly work together. But sometimes my hand scratches my ear a little too hard, and my ear comes back with, "Hey, man, that was too much," you know? We think about the church. We think about what it is that God is doing. And when we go through hardships, when we go through trials, when things happen that just don't seem right, even when we look at something in the church and we think, you know what, that's just not right. It's not that it's not right. It's how do we go about handling it in our hearts? How do we go about dealing with those difficult to reconcile things? We saw that with John the Baptist. He says, "I know this is the one who's coming, and I do believe you're the Messiah, but help me make sense of this. Are we waiting for something else?" And he responds, you know, that I love at the very end of when he talks about that stumbling block. "Woe to anybody that I'm a stumbling block to." Meaning, I don't want you to get sidetracked by all the traditions and the other things that you expected and the things you carried with you. I want you to understand that the work that was being done, the healing, the raising people from the dead, that's what I'm here for. That's what I came to do. You know, we see this about the body. Do we doubt God when we see things within the church that don't quite fit what we expect? Or do we say, you know what? I'll allow it because I trust that God is going to work it out. And I will address it, but I will trust that God will take care of it. The unity and growth of the church depends on each part overcoming doubt with faith in him. You overcome the doubt, the uncertainty, by doing exactly what we saw John doing. He went to Jesus. When something doesn't sound right, when, and I know this never happens here, if the preacher says something that doesn't make sense to you, say, well, that didn't sound quite right. Do we doubt? Do we go on our shell? Do we withdraw? Do we get cynical? Do we lose faith in God? There's a lot of reasons to be cynical about the church. There's a lot of reasons to be critical about the church. There's literally tons of reasons. But do we take that doubt and that cynicism and do we give it to Jesus and say, make this make sense? Help me to reconcile this because I don't want to give up on you. I don't want someone else and their lack of faith, their lack of perspective, their lack of understanding you and your love to deter me and keep me away from you. How do we handle the doubt that's in our life? What made John so amazing was that just like the rest of the prophets, just like so many men in the Bible, they were willing to reason that even though this isn't right, even though this doesn't make sense to me, even though I can't quite piece this together, God, I'm going to trust that you have a reason and that you have a way. Is that our attitude? Is it reflected in our lives that we trust God even when it doesn't necessarily make sense to us? A few questions I want to end with here. Number one, am I willing to suffer, sacrifice, and defer my rights for others to have justice and so that Christ can be seen through me? You know, we think about what it means to defer. And what's so important is that, you know, when we come together as a church, when we think about our role, what part of the body are we? What it is that we do so that the church can have a presence and help others see him more clearly. Do we come to church for us? Or do we come to church for others? You know, do we see ourselves as we have to come to church? We're getting something from this? Because let's face it, sometimes, you know, people walk in here and they're here on Sunday morning and they think, well, that preacher wasn't particularly inspiring. Well, did you come for the preaching? Or did you come to be a blessing to somebody else? Did you come to just get? Or did you come to give? Very often, if we're thinking about our own stuff, then we lose sight of why we're to be like Christ. And what tangible way can I bring? You know what? These are the wrong notes. It happens. See, this is what I'm talking about. It happens. It happens to the best of us. Somehow, and I can't even blame this one on Jimmy, I messed up the slide. So you guys are just going to have to listen to me as far as these questions. I don't even know how this happened. Give me just a second here. You know what? Actually, that's messed up too. So I'm just going to freestyle it. The third thing I want to ask is, do we consider, in the way that John the Baptist was, in the way that John the Baptist understood his role and he understood what it was that he was doing, do you consider yourself like one of the prophets, like John the Baptist? Do you consider yourself able to carry out the work that God has for you, even in a church situation or even in situation that may not seem ideal? Because very often, it's like we want the perfect scenario. We want the perfect situation. We want everything to make sense. It's what I call being kind of fragile, where any little mishap, any problem, any little drama, and I don't mean just one incident. I mean, it could go on for a while. You know, you may have that relationship that's struggling. You may have that problem that's going on with your children or your marriage or something. And any little thing, we begin to doubt and question God instead of saying, you know what? Even in this, I know that God is going to be glorified. Do we have that attitude? Do we understand that God truly is perfect, that he truly is faithful? Or do we only get stuck on that situation, that moment, that relationship, that thing that is causing us trouble. Because it's very easy to look at John the Baptist and think, well, John, I mean, Jesus clearly thinks you're, you know, this wonderful guy, and he clearly appreciates everything that you did. And yet John was troubled. He had doubt. We are going to have doubt. You know, I was sharing with someone, a young man a few weeks back, where he frankly just has doubt that God is real. He's like, I don't trust all these scriptures. I don't trust all this research. You know, I don't trust the people, the scholars. I don't trust that this stuff exists. And, you know, I told him, I said, well, even if you did, none of that produces faith. You know, there's a passage where it talks about, I believe it's James chapter 2. He says, you believe that there is one God. Good. Even the demons believe that and shudder. We come together not just because we believe, but we have to be of faith. We can't just say, I believe that there's a God. What does that faith and that belief compel you to do? Does it compel you to share with other people? Does it compel you to pray for and with other people? Does that faith compel you to say, you know what? I'm not living for him, and I know I need to be. So, God, I'm going to bring myself to you. Whatever you need to do, even if it is, I'm going to endure some hardship. Even if it is, I'm going to endure some ridicule and some punishment. Do we have the attitude that says, you know what? I'm not just a believer. I don't just believe that there's a God, like James 2 says, but I actually have faith that produces works. As a church, we have to work. You know, I talked about the success, relative success that John the Baptist had. One thing that stands out about him from the other prophets is that John the Baptist, oh, he had droves of people coming from everywhere. And he didn't go into the cities and go to all the popular places and things like that. No, he stayed right where he was, right out there in the wilderness. Looking wild, too. They gave a description, and I thought, man, he's kind of scary, right? And people were coming to him. You know, sometimes in ministry, you know, my struggle is feeling like, well, God, if I'm really doing what you're asking me to do, then where are the people? Where are the people? You know, I'm preaching the truth. I'm teaching the truth. Where are the people? You know, in other ways, we can look at our lives and think, but God, I've given myself to you. Why isn't this situation getting better? Why isn't my job prospects getting better? Why is my money getting better? Why isn't my marriage getting better? And when that doubt creeps in, when that feeling of, well, where is God in this moment? This doesn't quite reconcile and make sense. Do we then reach out? Do we reach out and say, help this make sense? Make this make sense to me? Or do we withdraw? Do we let that doubt turn into fear, turn into bitterness? If you're a person who you might be thinking to yourself, you know what? Guilty as charged. I know that I've allowed my doubt to keep me from giving my best and my most. If you're in that position today, come forward as we stand and sing our song of invitation so that we can pray for you. As a church, we can help you. If you're a person who you've never giving your life to God because of those doubts, don't walk away from here in doubt. Allow us as a church to help you and teach you. Allow the word to penetrate your life. Allow it to be something where you walk away from here without doubt, but knowing that even if it doesn't all make sense today, knowing that you have done what you needed to do to be right with God. Please stand as we sing our song of invitation.